Welcome one and all to the Stock Up Podcast, your one-stop shop for stocking up on the information you need to qualify for the Pro Tour. My name is Alex. I'm joined today, as always, by my co-host, one Jacob Negro. Jacob, how was your weekend?
Pretty good. Testing for the Pro Tour.
Yeah. Did you bother playing in the arena qualifier?
Nope. Okay. I knew that my... because I finished top 1200 Mythic in August and Limited, so I have the 20 play-in points, and I decided just to save them.
Okay, that's smart. I didn't have 20 play-ins. Because I cashed the arena open, and it was you have to join on the 13th, so...
Yeah, I think
You might as well get the gems.
Yeah, Standard was just not on my mind, and I'm sure I would have played Cauldron, but I didn't want to think about the list or things like that, and...
It's pretty boring.
I used to play some Modern with my teammates, so I just did that instead.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's interesting that there's gonna be a ban, but there's not a ban.
Yeah,
I actually had the thought that maybe they should just go back to just being we're never gonna ban anything ever again, and then maybe that would force them to design better, but. Because it's tough if they ban something and then just something else is really busted again. What the hell? What are they going to do? This might just be...
Yeah, that's kind of what happened. There was a rotation in between. Yeah. They banned 7 guards. And this is where we're at. It's not pretty.
Yeah, and it almost feels like they should ban more than one this time, too. But
yeah.
Maybe that's just the wrong... That's kind of what makes me think it's just maybe the wrong way to do things. Maybe it's too much of a buyout for them to not design the cards properly. Who knows? We went so long without needing to ban stuff in the past.
Yeah.
Hard to say.
It's just tough in the days of, Arena. And just, the digital age, I guess.
Yeah.
There's probably been a lot of standards that could have looked like this a decade ago, but the information wasn't really there to demonstrate that was the case.
Right, although a lot of the time Standard was only 1 or 2 years for rotation, too.
Yeah, so that's fair. Things
I feel like
changed,
they've stepped on their foot
set,
there.
A new set being more impactful was definitely huge,
Yeah.
Now the new sets hardly do anything. This Spider-Man set doesn't really count because it's small and kind of almost looks like it was designed to be underpowered.
It does. Looks like it was designed to maybe be a supplemental set.
Yeah, a Commander set, and then they switched it to something else, and then they realized... they better tone it down because of that kind of context.
Right. It does. And then the Through the Omen Paths has a bunch of art from, I guess that could be a Through the Omen Paths unique thing, but it has a bunch of art. It almost looks like it has art from sets past that maybe they decided not to use.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Slightly lower quality art, but still fits in with some of the older sets themes, Bloomberg.
Yeah, I can see
that
Through the Omen Paths have stuff from a lot of different planes. They definitely didn't try to make... some of these seem like they're on a made-up plane, but some of them are very much just from... one of them is called Lost in Litjara. That's just Kaldheim.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it puts us in a little bit of an awkward spot for the podcast because, Standard's not that interesting to talk about. We're waiting for the Modern Pro Tour.
Yeah.
Before something interesting happens. It's not... I'm sure Jacob would talk about Modern, but it's not great. He's on a testing team, so doing a just full-fledged Modern episode doesn't make a ton of sense either.
We also kind of did one a couple weeks ago that isn't... I'm not, trying to hide anything when I talk about how strong I think decks are, or, what the appeals are.
Exactly, yeah. And we don't want to retread ground. So, besides, the only thing we would be left to talk about is, I don't know what exactly you're doing, in which case...
Yeah, exactly.
Not exactly, yeah. So, we decided we would do a fundamentals episode today. Our last one went pretty well, and we had some good... feedback from it. So today we're going to be talking about mana efficiency in Magic, something that's really important. It's talked about a lot, but it's a pretty deep topic. And especially since, mostly anything is talked about is use all your mana in one turn. I think that's the most common advice. But it goes deeper than that for sure.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. I guess I'll start off with kind of a quote. Maybe I don't have it exactly right, but it's from Alan Wu, who has written a lot of articles usually around when he plays a Pro Tour or does well at a Pro Tour, he'll write one. But one he wrote had the phrase, like, people think way too much about what their cards do and not enough about how they cost. And I think that can be applied to almost every step of Magic, both when you're playing in-game, but also when you're building a deck or drafting a deck.
Mm-hmm. And it's not always super obvious. You know, obviously Counterspell is much better than Cancel. But nowadays, most of the time when a card is cheaper, it's not strictly better. It does something different.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of evaluation that goes in there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we have kind of an outline we're going to go through. Before that, I want to remind everyone that you can find us over on patreon.com/StockUpPodcast. Thank you to all our supporters over there. We really appreciate it. And if you'd like to join, it's just $1 a month at the moment. You get access to all of our content. And then, of course, you could also listen to us for free on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. So, yeah, let's get into it. Certainly when it comes to mana efficiency, the first place to start is why that matters in a game of Magic. So why don't we start there?
Yeah, so I mean, simply put, you know, if you just take your average constructed deck, you know, obviously you could build your deck in a weird way where this might not be true, but for the most part, you're spending the most mana is going to kind of just be the goal, because your cards that cost more mana are hopefully doing more powerful things than your cards that do less mana. And I think a lot of people recognize this, but there's a bit more to it. And one thing I want to call out specifically, and I'm going to use, I guess, it doesn't have to be Boros Energy as an example, but this is a deck with a lot of one drops, so this is a good example. If it's turn two and you have two mana cards in your hand and two 1-mana cards in your hand and some lands, maybe you already played a one drop. I think a lot of people really like playing the 2-1 drops. By default, they kind of see that as the most powerful play and they call it mana efficient. But that's not as mana efficient as playing a 2-drop, weirdly enough, because this kind of goes into just like a natural sort of playing for future turns feeling. Because if you play 2 1-drops and the next turn you draw a land or another 2-drop, you're just going to have 3 2-drops in your hand and 3 mana. Whereas if you had played a 2-drop on turn 2, then on turn 3, you'll still get that double spell that you could have had the previous turn, and then you'll still have a 1-drop for like a future double spell turn.
Yeah, that makes sense. So basically what you're saying is, it's not necessarily that you're... I mean, the first step is to say, okay, spend all your mana in one turn. But what's really going on is you're essentially just doing long-term planning. And the best way for the future turns to go well is to be optimizing which spells you're casting and which spells are left in your hand.
Yeah, I'm not saying, obviously, you know, everything's contextual. But at its baseline, the way to get the most, like, powerful plays long term is to effectively play the most expensive card in your hands that you can play.
Okay, but what if you don't, like, for the next few turns, like, you don't have more cards in your hand where it matters?
Yeah, definitely. That's something that's going to break that kind of pattern. But I think in modern day Magic, you have a lot of games that basically from start to end, especially when 2-for-1 cards get involved, that from start to end, you'll find you might be able to make just spend all your mana. You know, the game might only last 5 turns, as an example.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of mana sinks, lots of lands.
Yeah.
To spend your mana on, that sort of thing. What do you consider, like, cards you would draw in the future? How much does that play into your?
Exactly. That's kind of what I was saying. Let's take my previous example, but your hand, you know, maybe you're a little flooded. And you have 2 1-drops and a 2-drop as, you know, your only spells on turn 2. We could make it even better. You have 2 1-drops, 2-drop, a 3-drop. And if you play with 2 1-drops now, then your 3-drop next turn, and then you draw like another 3-drop in those time that you've had these draw steps, then on turn 4, you're still only playing a 3-drop. But you might have had some opportunity to, like, have played a 2-drop. But, you know, it's a little weird because once you get too far down the line, you might have given up a powerful turn for too many turns in a row. I think kind of what I think about is that you recognize if you double spell on this turn, you're going to have a really powerful turn, but will the game meaningfully change enough on the previous, on the like following turn that that still wouldn't be true? I think this is really true of removal spells, where like you see this opportunity to maybe double spell, but it involves a removal spell. But if you just played your like big expensive creature, like in limited, for example, you might just outclass the thing you want to kill anyways. And if they kill your big expensive creature, you know, if it's still kind of early in the game and you just take some damage, like that's okay. You know, like if you're talking about like a shock or something that is only going to impact on, you know, it's only going to answer a small creature anyways, you could just maybe be okay with that creature living one more turn to develop yourself and actually see, you know, put your opponent to the test yourself.
So why, you mentioned double spelling. Why is double spelling good? If you play, so I'm assuming, you know, you're saying like on turn six, you might want to play in a way where you can play 2-3 drops instead of your 1-5 drop, but isn't your 5 drop going to be more powerful than your 3 drops?
Yeah, usually it's kind of in limited. Yeah, like a 5 drop will probably be more powerful than a 3 drop and a 2 drop. But I guess I'm saying like you might not have the 5 drop. I think what I'm just trying to point out is that by playing the most expensive spell each turn, as you have a draw step each turn, you're increasing your options later.
Okay, so increases your options, yeah. And then if it's the case that playing 2 spells is better, then you get to play.
Yeah, and that's still the turn you can do it. Yeah.
And playing 2 spells, I mean, I would assume, even though a 3 drop is worse than a 5 drop, that a lot of the time, just getting the 2 spells is still going to be more powerful. That's what I was getting at. I don't know usually. How often you think that is the case, but yeah.
No, I think it is too. Yeah, I mean, I guess to like narrow down with the Boros one, this is kind of hard, but I actually kind of watched this game recently where it's like on turn two, your hand has like, it's a little tough if I say it's Guide of Souls and Ocelot of Pride because those cards play so well together. So let's say it's Guide of Souls and Ragavan. And then you also have Ajani and Goblin Bombardment. And, you know, it's like if you play
Guide of Souls, 2 1-drops and 2 2-drops.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like if you play the 2 1-drops, then like on the following turn, I think your turn's just going to look a lot worse than if you kind of develop a 2-drop and then play a 2-drop and a 1-drop. But it's super contextual. I'm thinking more in like maybe a Boros Mirror as an example, or maybe a more attrition-based mirror, because in like a fast matchup, then sure, like double spelling faster might be the pressure you need. But if you're kind of just playing the type of matchup where both players are going to answer each other's things, I think this is going to happen a lot. I think this is a much older example, but there was a Yorion deck in Modern that was kind of known as the best deck with like Omnath, Solitude, Renin 6, Expressive Iteration, pretty much all 2-for-1s, Teferi, Time Raveler. This deck was notoriously good at like never running out of cards. In fact, you literally had a companion too that like drew you some cards. And the mirrors with that deck, this kind of plays into it, were known to be pretty grindy and slow, and potentially they could go to time. So my advice playing that deck was to look at your most mana efficient play, which also includes, like I said, playing the most expensive card in your hand, seeing if that play is going to kind of just pass the checks for this turn, like it's not a horrible play, and usually just making that play if I'm playing mirrors.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me in mirrors in general, I would say. I wonder how true that is across the board, because, I mean, just at a baseline logic level, if you're playing pretty much the same strategy and the same cards as your opponent, you would think whoever played the more of them would win.
Yeah, exactly.
That might be the case in a lot of matchups, but it's less obvious, you know, if you have two completely different strategies and different mana costs on your cards and whatnot.
Yeah, and then this kind of plays into it, but you also want to keep in mind what your opponent's mana efficient plays are, especially when you get into Constructed, where they're playing 4 of a lot of cards, and try to make it awkward for them. It's kind of play, I think it's kind of interesting. This all happened around the same time where Hearthstone came out as a game, the Blizzard card game that was digital only.
Mm-hmm.
And in that game, you just get a mana per turn Like it's like you just hit your first 10 land drops and you don't have a deck that involves lands at all, and your deck is just 30 spells.
Right. Okay.
So that's a great example of really needing to be mana efficient, because you're just going to have spells to play pretty much the entire game. And I think plays were often telegraphed. And if you watch that game at the top level, what I'm talking about was what a lot of top players talked about. Now, obviously, there's a lot of differences in Magic, but I do think as time has gone on and the cards have gotten more powerful and they kind of help you smooth out your draws anyways, because they're cantripping or just kind of flexible in costs, maybe, you know, they're modal. I find this just the game kind of looks a lot more like that in a lot of games you'll play. Not you to 10 mana, but maybe to 5, you know?
Yeah. You know, as someone who took a several-year break from playing Magic, almost completely, certainly completely from Constructed Magic. I hadn't played Constructed Magic in a couple years. When I came back, I had sort of a light bulb moment when I was playing Historic on Arena and the Modern Horizon cards, first hit Arena, and the Boros Energy deck, funny enough, first came into prominence. And to me, it looked like the sort of deck that you could just beat by playing like lots of cheap creature removal and sweepers and whatnot. But the pure efficiency of the cards had really evolved, especially that set, where it was a Modern Horizon set, wasn't a standard set, and I hadn't played Constructed in a long time. And I was just kind of shocked by how much the one mana cards, you know, Boros Energy, just a deck filled with one drop creatures that are efficient, backed up by some two drops that are efficient. That's kind of it. They've got at the top of the curve, they've got Flage, also a pretty efficient card because you can spend the 3 mana on it, and then also it's going to come out of your graveyard to fill your curve at some point. So that was the first moment I really started noticing that Magic was really going into this direction in an extreme way, where filling your deck with cheap cards and playing all of them was really important. And I mean, it had always sort of been this way in Eternal formats, like Legacy and Vintage. And I think just the evolution of all formats is essentially going to look like that.
Yeah. This is an even older example, but I think it's a great one that I remember Alexander Hain actually said on his podcast when he had one. He was at, I think, Pro Tour Aether Revolt and had a Heart of Kirin that he could have played on turn 2. But he was on the draw and knew that these kind of vehicles mirrors either had cards like Fragmentize or Release the Gremlins, and they also had Gideon. So they have these pretty good sorcery speed answers to Heart of Kirin. So he didn't actually play his Heart of Kirin on turn 2. And this might be a result of, you know, maybe not having a lot of spells in your hands. So you want to plan it to kind of make things more awkward for his opponent. But he played it on turn 3 on the draw. And that's because if his opponent wanted to play Gideon on turn 4, ideally, you wouldn't be facing down Heart of Kirin. But given he only really has sorcery speed answers to Heart of Kirin, by waiting one turn to play it, he kind of now has made his opponent either choose to play Gideon or first play an answer. And if he plays an answer to the Heart of Kirin, then that means that Alexander gets to play his Gideon first, which is a huge deal.
Okay, that's interesting. So basically, like, one of the ways to win the mana efficiency game can be to set your opponent's mana efficiency off balance as well.
Yeah, or maybe realize, you know, maybe not every turn is about thinking about mana efficiency, but something like a powerful 4-drop that you both have. And once again, you know, this is a mirror match, so I think your point is pretty true that this comes up most often in this type of situation where you're both playing with very similar cards. But yeah, ideally, you're playing your big kind of haymaker before your opponent is, so making it as awkward as possible on the turns leading up to it when you're on the draw is a great way to maybe steal that initiative.
Okay. One of the first times I wasn't terribly, you know, wouldn't say I was terribly good at Magic yet at this time, but I remember when Mantis Rider, like those Jeskai decks that played Mantis Rider a lot, were in Standard. And yeah, that same dynamic would come up where even against non-mirrors, sometimes you would choose not to play your Mantis Rider into open mana. That was really common. Because if your opponent got to kill your thing and then play their Mantis Rider or their Goblin Rabble Master or
yeah, I was gonna say Rabble Master was like it was the combination of the two, and Rabble Master was the one that gave some lasting value if you didn't answer it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's another example I can think of. So haste creatures, I've had that come up a couple times, you know, since throughout the years. Like even recently, I remember playing a game online against Nova Hellkite, and something similar came up. Or I was playing with Nova Hellkite, sorry, in my I was playing mono red a bit.
It can come up with what's again with Boros Energy. Sometimes you want to play Guide of Souls and Ocelot Pride in the same turn. And you know, that's potentially gonna net you one or more tokens from this Ocelot Pride. So you want to kind of find opportunities to do that when your opponent maybe doesn't have mana up. And, you know, when you play these mirrors, I don't think it's weird to maybe pass with Galvanic Discharge or Lightning Bolt instead of developing your own game plans, because you're trying to be the one to kind of not blink first and get kind of a good playoff that nets you a little bit of advantage.
So when your opponent has like lots of reactive cards, when they're playing, maybe they're playing a much more reactive deck than you are, what are some lessons we can learn there?
Is it
the
same
sort of thing?
It's kind of the opposite where you're thinking about theirs. I think playing against blue-white control is like a classic example for me. Especially there's an era where both in Standard and Pioneer, the blue-white control decks had like Absorb, Memory Deluge, and the Wandering Emperor. And they didn't have really any instance besides Absorb or maybe Dovin's Veto on turn three. So I think a lot of the times when I played against those types of decks, I would maybe not cast a spell into their three open mana. And then when they passed a four mana, I'd cast some of my best plays possible, because I don't want to let them just play a Wandering Emperor or a Memory Deluge on a board they feel comfortable on. And also on that turn three, I don't want to let them just absorb when they literally can't do anything else but cast absorb.
So that's another example of sort of making them play off balance in terms of mana efficiency. And of course, if they don't get to absorb something and maybe you're hitting them with a two drop.
Yeah, certainly if you already have things on the board, that's, you know, really leaning in favor of that. But I think that some people think just because they don't have something on the board that that's true. But I do think you can kind of get to a spot where you both just effectively skip a turn into counterspell magic. And Three Steps Ahead is super guilty of this as well. We're like, sure, they could do the looting ability and draw two and discard one, but that's not really netting them a big advantage anyways, so you don't really mind that. And like then they have, you know, Consult the Star Charts or Coil and Catch on turn four. So you make things a lot more awkward for them by waiting one turn before you start kind of casting your spells. And I think when you do this, you'll discover that, you know, I think sometimes you play against a blue-white control deck and it feels like they have perfect answers and kind of just meet, you know, they answer all the questions your deck is providing kind of easily. But I think if you really think about kind of keeping them off balance and making it harder for them to spend their mana in the perfect way they want to, you'll find, oh, like they missed a land drop and they don't get to ultimate me or things like that. You know, like
If you ever play those decks too, you'll realize that sometimes the margins are pretty thin. And if you don't get to use the right card in the right situation, maybe you're forced to use it. And like even as something as simple as if you're forced to use a different answer because your opponent made your turn awkward, then maybe you don't have the correct answer on a later turn, or maybe you miss a land drop because you weren't able to play your draw three. That's pretty common, and that can be pretty disruptive for decks like that to be playing passing and missing land drops, especially if you're still progressing your land and your board. So yeah, that'll make sense.
Yep. But yeah, it's always hard to identify exactly. I'm thinking still about this Pioneer example, and I would play Mono Green Devotion at the time, which is just like a green combo deck that played a lot of large creatures, so you could also kind of pressure the board. And it played Planeswalkers, Karn the Great Creator, like, which is kind of, you know, a headache if you resolve it against a control deck. And Karn's like an exact example of like the type of card where it's like, I'm not going to play it into Absorb, but I'm totally happy to play it into four open mana, because it's kind of a card that's really difficult for them to deal with otherwise.
Gotcha. And if you wait too long, you know, they might deluge into more answers.
Yeah, I definitely think this is kind of generally in Magic, but, you know, thinking a bunch of turns ahead, I think, is kind of fake and not, you know, what actually happens. But thinking what's going to happen next turn is extremely valuable. And it's going to be really close to accurate as you kind of get experience and play a lot, because, you know, you're both only going to draw one card from kind of the information or tells you have from that point.
I will say, I noticed something recently. So I used to watch Gab Nassif stream years ago. It's funny how long he's been going. And I've started watching his YouTube content recently. And he has this new lingo that he uses in almost every video. In like several games, he'll bring it up that I don't remember him used to bring up. And he'll say things like, you know, he'll be looking at his hand. He'll be talking out loud about all the different things he's considering, some fancy plays. And then a lot of the time he just goes, I should just play my cards. And then he, like, you know, plays something, like he'll play a seam rip on a profs, even though it's not a particularly effective play, or he'll end a turn consult the star charts for just 2 mana, even though he kind of wanted to wait. So I wonder what you think of that sort of that credence or that shortcut, just play your cards.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. This is always something, you know, playing at both local levels and the pro tour level that I'll notice. I would say that stronger players will put pressure on the game faster, and pressure on the game doesn't necessarily mean board presence, but it means they're going to play towards kind of their way they're winning the game, whether it's controlling it or things like that, in a manner that I think just happens faster more often. I know that's kind of weird to say, but I think this is also a lesson I've learned, once again, from another game, Teamfight Tactics or any auto battler, which I know might be a bit out of the scope of our listeners, but you're kind of just like playing board. Like you want to build up to the synergistic kind of grand finish, but like ultimately often the playing, just like you look at all your options in a turn and you make your battlefield like as strong as it can be from turn to turn is like a very good strategy. And, you know, I don't mean that to mean only board presence in Magic, but just, you know, what are you actually trying to do to win this game, and what steps do you need to do that? And, you know, example of like consult the star charts of like, especially if you're playing this control deck facing down an aggro deck, you know, you might just, the way you win this game probably doesn't involve a kick consult the star charts for many turns down the line, you know?
And yeah, so maybe you just use it. And there's always the potential you run out of cards. But if you just, you know, play your cards.
More prepared to answer the immediate things your opponents are playing. Because, you know, it's kind of like what I'm saying, where you're like, oh, like, I'm going to hold this consult the star charts for turn four. And then your opponent plays something really good on turn four. And you just need to answer it, you know?
Right. Yeah. This comes up in Limited sometimes when... Maybe you leave up mana for a removal spell. Maybe it's like a 4-mana removal spell, or you leave up mana for whatever counter spells in the format, and your opponent plays a card that's like kind of crappy, comparatively, and you don't really want to kill it, but sometimes you just go, you know what, I should just use my cards so I don't fall behind, and I'm just going to spend my good removal spell on this kind of crummy creature, because even that crummy creature might kill you, or you might fall behind. And of course there's always a line. I mean, sometimes you even in Modern Limited, you do save your removal spell because you know they have a bomb that's more important, and this is the only way to answer it you have in your deck, that sort of thing.
Yeah, certainly. That's a bit of a side note, but, and it's probably something I've mentioned before, but it's about playing aggressive decks in limited formats, where like I think sometimes people think bomb creatures, you know, if you play a slower control deck, that, you know, you'll see this card more often or something like that. But if you play an aggro deck and you have a Baneslayer Angel in your deck, it's way more likely your opponent will have had to use their premium removal spell before you even got to turn five. And your Baneslayer
Angel
might
just because you're pressuring them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of pressuring your opponent, I mean, I liked your example of even from a control, even if you're a reactive deck, if you're pressuring the game in the direction that you usually win, maybe that's clearing the board and casting a card, drawing spell or finisher or whatever. The faster you do that, you know, your opponent isn't always going to have a perfect hand. Sometimes they're going to stumble, this sort of thing. So pressuring them in that sort of manner might actually, you know, a lot of times just going to work.
Yeah, I think, you know, you have to think of each step of the game. You you're kind of always matching pace with your opponent to some extent, I think. And I think sometimes people maybe slow down or do something kind of weird because they're playing around something their opponent might have. But I think playing around things is a luxury that you have when you're ahead in the game. You don't have to be far ahead, but you have to demonstrate by some means that you're a little ahead, I think. And when the game's kind of totally even, it's just, I think people pass up on opportunities to just play something that's going to say, here, like, if this works, I'm ahead, you know? And if it doesn't work, we're back to even.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's a little weird when you're talking about leaving up counter spells or things like that, but I think specifically about, like, playing a creature or waiting for your opponent to not have removal or something weird, I think people maybe get in their heads a bit too much about that.
Yeah, totally.
Like, the Rabble Master and Open Mana thing might be a good example of that, where you really, it's not correct every time to not play the Rabble Master into the Lightning Strike mana. You know, you need to have maybe a Lightning Strike of your own for their Rabble Master or things like that. You know, like, sometimes you're just supposed to play the Rabble Master and you'll figure out that it works sometimes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's great when it works, because then you're like, oh, they don't have any removal for it, you know? Like,
yeah, or maybe you have second Rabble Master and a Mantis Rider in your hand, and you're just figuring, well, if they ever run out, if they have, you know, if they don't have exactly three removal spells, I'm going to get them.
Yeah, no, and that's true with all of these. She's having fun.
Yeah.
Like the example with the mono green deck too, you know, sometimes I would jam into an absorb because I look at my hand and I'm like, well, I'm just going to play a good card four turns in a row here and hope that two of them work or something like that, you know?
Right. And that's a way of throwing your opponent off. I mean, if you're playing, if you're going to, I'm going to jam into absorb twice and then have a third thing. And then what are you going to do? Memory deluge when I just play my great five drop. Yeah. All makes sense. So that, I mean, that covers most of the scenarios we want to talk about in game, I would say, unless you can think of anything else. How do you apply this sort of thing in deck building?
Yeah, so lowering your curve and especially finding more opportunities for, I feel like I love reactive one drops because they are just a lot less suspicious to leave up. They slot into your curve on more turns throughout the game, like I was kind of talking with one drops.
So Spell Pierce, Lightning Bolt.
Yeah, exactly. Into the Flood Maw, things like that. And I've even, you know, I've talked about in these Cauldron decks, you know, maybe main decking an Anole at times. And I wouldn't talk about that if it was, obviously a 2-mana Anole would be worse, but you know, a 2-mana Counterspell is not in the same league to me as a really conditional 1-mana Counterspell.
Right. Even if it was, you know, a null plus you got to scry one or something. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Some other advantage.
Yeah.
Would be even close. Yeah.
How much
better is a 1-mana card than a 2-mana card in that example? Or a 2-mana card to a 3-mana card?
I think those are all huge jumps. I think in limiteds too, something people don't keep in mind is kind of the math behind your lands. You know, you're probably keeping, you know, you're going to keep hands that have a certain number of lands. So usually you hit your fifth land drop. Like on average, if you didn't count mulliganing, you would miss your fifth land drop on the play like half your games. But that's not entirely
true. 17 lands?
Yeah. But that's not entirely true because you would, you know, that involves some subset of games where you're keeping one or zero lands or something that you wouldn't do. But it's probably still like, I don't know, 25% of your games on the play, even after mulliganing, you're probably just like not going to hit your fifth land drop. And then when you extend that further out, you know, you need to actually have plans for expensive cards this is true, I guess, in Constructed too. I don't know why it's specific to Limited. You know, you can't just play like an expensive 7-drop, I'd say, in any format without having some plan to accelerate into it or really, you know, card draw to hit your land drops, things like that. Because I don't think hitting your 7th land on turn 7, if you just play 40% lands in your deck, is a thing that happens. Yeah, in like, you know, you probably hit your 7th land on turn 7, what, in like turn 9? Something like that?
Certainly in Limited, yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that.
In Constructed, if you were playing no card draw, just 24 lands, I think that's also going to be about the same.
No cantrip creatures. Yeah, no. You know, it's interesting because in different points in Magic's past, usually in lower powered formats is essentially the solve here. In lower powered formats, you might be able to just sort of wait until you draw more land because games are going to take longer. But especially in modern Magic, I mean, if you're not doing something onto the board almost every turn, especially in Constructed, you know, you're just going to lose. You can't just have seven drops sitting in your hand and you're not going to have a play for turn five. And what that means realistically is if you have expensive cards in your deck, you need some amount of ramp. You need some amount of
card draw,
even card draw, cantrip creatures, things to, you know, on turn two, maybe the creatures that see play surveil or draw a card or something. That all matters.
The longer the game goes, the more likely it is you'll draw the expected distribution of lands and spells in your deck.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but I guess also to shortcut that, not necessarily the longer, the more you go through your deck. So by drawing more cards, it's more likely you'll hit kind of the expected, you know, you drew 40% lands in your top 20 cards. So now you have 8 lands in your top 20 cards.
Mm-hmm. People in Standard right now like to play this. Well, I don't know if they do anymore. They might have figured out it's bad, but they were playing this like white-black Ketramos control deck to try to beat Vivi because it had lots of things that exiled, basically. And I mean, decks like that, in theory, could be good, but the reason that deck was bad is there was really no way to smooth your draws, and you were just kind of hoping to play a removal spell every turn and then play an Elspeth on turn five or whatever. But I just think with a deck like that, you're going to have so many games where you're not hitting your land drops, you're having to play inefficient cards on inefficient turns, and the plan of building your deck really does matter for mana efficiency because you want to make sure you're hitting land drops if you're going to play cards on curve and get to the point where you're double spelling. And, you know, if you put 5 and 6 mana cards in your deck, you also need ways to a plan to get there.
Yeah, definitely. Even 4 mana cards, things like that, I think are not necessarily the norm in modern day Magic. A lot of decks, aggressive decks, their curve just stops at 3. In modern, you even see that kind of, obviously there's Quantum Riddler, but that has kind of a buyout that's drawing you cards into lands. It's not that weird to even miss a 4th land drop in a game of Magic. Thinking of times that I've played a deck against the various control deck where they play a 4 mana sweeper like Day of Judgment or Supreme Verdict, and maybe I decide I can't really play around that card, and I hope to, you know, in my mind, all I'm thinking about is like, please don't have it, you know? But then it's actually one better than that, or maybe not one better, but it's the other out that you don't always think about, which is they just missed their 4th land drop, and that's why they lose. And they did have it, you know?
Yeah.
Or it's tapped, things like that.
That makes sense. I mean, there's a reason why the blue-white control decks in this format play 27 land. I mean, that's just a ton. It's almost half the spells, you know, almost half their deck is land. So they're going to be flooded a lot of the time.
Yeah, and of course, I think it makes sense. And, you know, Shahar's been playing with Jeskai Revelations, and that's an example of, yeah, like playing 27 lands is kind of what is asked of you if you're trying to hit your 7th land drop on turn 7 or things like that in your constructed deck. That's another way around it.
Yeah, and it's not like he's just played 27 lands either. He's got, you know, stock ups or other card drawing to help hit. And of course, you know, blue-white control has access to Fountain Port and some creature lands and whatnot. So that all matters, and that'll make your deck better if you have those things as compared to not.
This is what I love doing with decks is finding spots to lower my curve, finding spots that maybe make sense to add a land or maybe a land with some ability, and also looking for potential mana sinks to put in, because this corrects kind of both ends of outliers where, you know, by having cheaper spells in my deck, I'm going to be able to play my earlier turns with better, you know, board impacting plays potentially. But I'm also going to, like, I want to hit my land drops. I want things to do with my mana in the late game. It's weird to say because they're kind of contradictory, but I really just think what I do with a lot of decks is try to find what I think are the worst cards in that deck and fill them in with cards of like the categories I just mentioned.
I love in Limited when you get a cool colorless land that's really good, and you just add it to your deck.
As an 18th land. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's kind of the perfect thing where you get to be mana screwed less often, and then you also have something to do.
Yep.
If you've drawn a lot of lands.
Yeah, cards lands I can with think abilities of, are perfect for this kind of category. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cards I may have underestimated when I first saw them, but it makes total sense that they see play in formats like Modern and Legacy, are the Land Cyclers from, was that Modern Horizons 2, maybe? Modern Horizons 1? Oh, Lord of the Rings. That's what they're from. Yep. Yeah, from Lord of the Rings. And it's really nice when you can play the Troll and have essentially, you know, three or four extra lands, depending on how you count them, or the five mana draw three and have a bunch of extra lands, and then...
Yeah. Lauren revealed, this is a good one to point at, but it's kind of a cheater card, in my opinion. I think... I mean, certainly it matters that it's a five mana draw three. They don't play it because it's just a blue land cycler, but they do play it to pitch to things like Force of Will or Subtlety in Modern and things like that.
That's fair.
I don't think I've seen a deck play these types of cards without those pitch spells in their deck.
I played Lorien Revealed in Historic in this same format where Boros Energy was legal, and I didn't have any pitch spells, and it was really good.
Did your deck have Brainstorm?
No, definitely not Brainstorm. It might have had Brain Surge in some numbers.
Yeah.
So that was part of it.
Yep.
But, you know...
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, Historic is a less, between format. It's a different format, to, right? Where the pitch spells aren't legal, but Lorien Revealed is. So that's fair.
Yeah, and Lorien Revealed was definitely good in that deck. And I guess I haven't played a ton of Modern, but I assumed that people were casting it maybe more than they are.
Well, when you put four in your deck, you'll definitely cast it. I mean, it's good enough to cast when you get to those spots, but you're not going to cast it every game.
And right.
Like I said, you wouldn't put it in your deck if it didn't have that ability on it, but the strength of that ability is not what makes it good, I guess.
Mm-hmm. This did make me think of another small topic, which is how do you consider cards with cycling in terms of mana efficiency?
Yeah, they don't really count. I was going to bring that up kind of talking about this in deck building because I'm kind of giving the benefit to the doubt to the decks that already exist when I was talking about in-game where like your cards have to do something with the mana you're spending on them or make sense. And, you know, obviously we could talk about even stock up of like, you know, that's, you know, spending three mana for a stock up on turn three is mana efficient, but it's not playing to the board at all. But you're just trying to set up for later, you know, and it still matters to be mana efficient with a card like stock up, right? Because maybe you're trying to find answers to your opponent's things and you want those answers ahead of time. And then adding to that, the things you're thinking about answering are probably your opponent's most mana efficient plays.
Yeah. So there's a limit to how many like cycling things you would play then.
And
spend mana to like just draw more cards and not back the board.
Yeah, and there's definitely a huge difference between literal cycling and like the card selection that something like Consult the Star Charts or Stock Up kind of offers.
Totally, yeah. It's cycling is sort of just like a buyout, whereas you know Stock Up is a progressive game plan.
Yeah, exactly.
Getting ahead by getting two specific cards. Trading one for two specific cards, yeah. Okay. Let's see. If you lower your curve, your deck's gonna... You have fail rate written here. What do you mean by fail rate?
So, you know, people think about a combo deck not drawing its combo. But, you know, any deck can draw way too many lands or not enough lands. And regardless, if every spell in your deck was good and didn't require to be drawn in combination with other spells, that deck will probably have less fail rate than others, but it's still going to just kind of not function some amount of games. You know, no deck's at really 100%. It's just kind of the nature of playing with lands and spells in Magic. So in my mind, I'm just trying to kind of decrease that fail rate in both directions when I'm approaching my deck. And, you know, cheap removal spells or cheap reactive cards. I specify reactive cards because those ones I think sometimes can trade up on a lot of mana. You know, something like a Lightning Bolt could kill even a three drop or things like that. A Spell Pierce is really well known for this, of, you know, countering a four mana.
Yeah. Sounds like you're saying there's a lot of upside to just lowering your curve. It's no surprise that I guess when you look at Eternal formats, they tend to have less and less land the more powerful the format is, essentially.
Yeah, or when Lurrus used to be legal in many formats, it was kind of a running joke of the companion requirement was to make your deck good, you know?
Right. Yeah. Something in, you know, in standard, if a deck like Blue Light Control or maybe some big green deck could just play 22 lands and just always still magically draw their land on time, they definitely would. Makes your deck more powerful for sure. But there's a cost to playing expensive cards, and I guess the calculus there is just finding out when it's worth it and when it's not. What about during drafting?
Yeah, so this is where you really put to the test of, like, understanding the power level of cards, because, you know, you can draft the cheapest cards in each pack and end up with a terrible deck. You know, obviously you need some kind of oomph. You need to have some kind of plan to play some powerful haymakers or things like that. I think one of the biggest things I think about when I draft is when there's an expensive card in a pack, especially like maybe a 5-mana uncommon, something that comes to mind, or a really strong 5-mana common. I really think, like, is this so much better than the other 5-drops in this set, you know? Because I often find in modern day draft formats that they're super replaceable. That I'll just take whatever 5-drops wheel in the pack, those are the ones I'll play in my draft deck, you know?
Mm-hmm. When I listen to Limited Resources, they do their set reviews. They rate all the cards on A through F scale. And where C is just like your average playable. And a lot of the time, something they'll say is they'll get to a 5-drop creature, they'll read it. You know, Marshall will be like, wow, this is actually pretty good. And Lisa's like, yeah, it's pretty good. And then they'll be like, well, I'll give this this is going to play kind of like a C+ or a B-, but you should pick it at like the, you know, C level, or you should pick it at the C- level, because there's just a limit to how many expensive cards you can pick, whereas it's not really the case for a cheap card. So yeah, the more expensive card is, it's going to get downgraded in some level when you're drafting, if you're doing it properly.
And I'm going to give a recent example that kind of is against what I said, because I drafted a lot of Aether Drift, and there's a common in Aether Drift called Thunderhead Gunner, which is 4 and a red for a 4/5 reach, and it said, discard a card, draw a card, activate only as a sorcery and only once each turn. It's hard without context to know how good this card is, but this set had a lot of little small flyers and not many things bigger than a 4/5. So this thing was pretty dominant on the battlefield. And this set was known to kind of not have a lot of mana sinks. So the discard a card, draw a card activated ability was one of the better kind of mana sinks in the game, even though it's not exactly what it is, but it prevented you from flooding out. This became my highest rated common by the end of that format, which is a little controversial because green was really well known as the strongest color in that set. So me taking this card over every green card is more like me declaring that I think green is really overdrafted by the end of Aether Drift format. But because I'm willing to take this card so highly, it affected how I drafted in other spots. And it made me often take very cheap cards throughout the rest of the draft, even if I hadn't seen this card yet. You know, because I'm just kind of waiting for this common often if red was open.
That makes sense. I actually didn't draft that format, so that's interesting. I can think of another example. I actually can't think of the exact card, but I've realized it doesn't really matter because I can just sort of talk about an archetype of a card that's appeared throughout the years, which is they often will print Manowar type effect at 5 mana nowadays. There'll be like a 5-mana blue common, like in a Dragons of Tarkir, there's the Serpent, 5-mana, 3/3. When it enters, you bounce a creature. In Kaldheim, there's the Blue Giant, 5-mana, 4/4. You lock down a creature, which is in a way similar to bouncing it, usually not as good. And there's some other creatures I can't really exactly remember, but those are other examples where it is nominally 5-mana, but because you're getting this sort of FTK effect, or you're making your opponent spend more mana on a creature that they've already spent mana on, that can be more efficient than, you know, just paying up 5 mana for a big dumb creature.
Yeah, definitely.
When you're drafting, how important is it to pick cheap cards?
So it's kind of interesting. In my mind, I'm really prioritizing the stronger cheap cards. Those are my favorite things to draft. Every now and then you have sets where the one drops are pretty good. That is not exactly where I'm at, but strong two drops is like really what I'm looking for. You know, in this set, in Edge of Eternity, sorry, to be clear, you have the, let me get his name, the red two drop uncommon 2/1 Kavu.
Mm-hmm.
That either gets you, your opponent chooses between two landers or it getting two counters. A card like that is like exactly what I'm talking about. Terror Pact Intimidator. You know, it's known as one of the strongest cards in the set, but I think I'm just sort of looking at it with a bit more priority. I think recently they've maybe even kind of made some of the two drops a little worse because people were doing this maybe too often, where just a lot of the two drops I felt like were scaling pretty well. If you think about like your curve throughout a game, turn four or turn five, you end up, you know, double spelling a lot more when you play a lot of two drops, you know, or twos and threes. So definitely I'll play a lot of decks where, you know, I'm just playing, you know, I don't know if I really have a quantity attached with it, but I'm willing to pretty much have an endless number of two drops as long as I feel like I can still have the power needed for my deck later.
Right. There's definitely a... It's hard to say that there's a maximum amount of cheap cards for your, even for your limited deck, whereas it's definitely the case for the expensive cards. So even though I took some years off of not really playing Constructed, I still drafted a lot of formats. And one thing that happened for a couple years is we had a string of formats that were like really aggressive, where one drops and two drops were really important. And I think there was actually a bit of backlash to that. And recently, well, like contemporarily, we might be in a time where they've sort of fixed that or they've adjusted it a bit. And now we're finally starting to see those adjustments. Because I agree, it does seem like maybe things are getting maybe a little slower.
Yeah, I mean, Edge of Eternities has felt pretty slow. You know, it's really funny. It keeps happening with white in these sets. Edge of Eternities, I think, is really guilty of it, where, like, if they're going to make a color aggressive, white is usually, white and red are usually the ones to do that. And then I just feel like I keep noticing in these sets where they're doing what you're kind of talking about, that white-red is, like, pretty much unplayably bad.
Yeah.
You really need some... It's not always true because, you know, in any pod, you could just end up getting a lot of uncommons and rares of those colors and your deck will be really broken. But if you just have to like build a deck of only commons and maybe you're limited to two of the same common, if you like look at the different decks, they like try to make this white red deck somehow aggressive, but then the cards are just really terrible. So it doesn't like add up, you know? Whereas, right. Like, I think Final Fantasy has some good white aggro things. Galakat is a good example. That's not a two-drop, but, you know, that was, like, an evasive, vigilant flyer, 3/3 if you had two artifacts. So just pretty good in the realm of combat, you know? It's going to get in a lot of damage, and it's hard to attack into. I would have said in Final Fantasy Draft that Dragoon's Lance was my rank one uncommon in the set.
Yeah, there's definitely been some instances of them still pushing certain two drops, and they, especially now that we have 17 lands data, I've been impressed with like high power cheap spells more so than I had been in the past, sort of realizing their value, I think, a bit more.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Terror Pact Intimidator, it's not my rank one uncommon, but it's really high up there. At Pro Tour Aether Drift, I got kind of rewarded for taking an early Rocketeer Boost Buggy and then getting another one. And part of my idea behind that, this is a red green, to keep it simple, it's a really above rate red green two drop. And so it kind of commits you to being exactly that color combo. But in my mind, it's just like, well, it's just like my deck's going to look really good if it works out that I'm this, like if I'm playing red green. And I have this type of card.
Yeah. I mean, you know, another thing that they've started to do on limited resources when they talk about like their rares, rare mythic set review, is they'll upgrade cheap rares compared to like 6 and 7 mana rares. which can sometimes be counterintuitive, I think, because the big, obviously the big 6 and 7 mana rares have huge effects on the game. But, you know, even something like a 3 mana rare, you got to think almost every time you draw it, you're going to be able to play it. Whereas you'll have games where you draw 7 mana rares and it doesn't matter how good they are because you lose the game before you can play them.
Yeah, and ultimately, you know, you play a game of limited. Even if the game lasts a full 7 turns or something, that means your opening hand was still half of, like, the sample of cards you saw that game, which just makes, you know, like, the cheap cards, you know, that's a stat you can look at, too, is the, like, opening hand win rate of cards. Mm-hmm. But even looking at the win rate of... It's interesting, it's missing mythic rares, I guess. Okay. The win rate of cards... both in opener and when drawn on 17 lands, you know, you can see Sunset Saboteur, for example, is way up there. And I can tell you, playing with and against that card, it's not that impressive on turn 4. You know, it's serviceable. It maybe trades more often. But the fact that it's up there is because, you know, 7's a huge sample of your deck. That's, you know, you a one of in, let me get the exact math here, I guess. I know it with... a 60-card deck, a one of, is going to show up in your opening hands like 11% of the time. It's actually, I think, a lot higher than people think.
Yeah, that's pretty high. I think it's roughly, the number I've always had in my head is roughly 40% to draw.
That must not be like a one four of.
Right? No, yeah, four of for 60 cards is roughly.
I was just 40%. Thinking of like your rare or whatever. So it's 17.5% in the limited.
Okay.
So, you know, almost 1 in 5 games. You're going to see this card in your opening hand.
Mm-hmm. And that's the 2-mana 4/1 menace. So having with ward, so having that on turn 2 is just insane.
Yeah. It's probably closer to 20% than I'm giving it credit for when you account for the fact that, like, you're not going to, you know, base your mulligan strategy entirely around this card, but when this card's in your opening hand, you're really likely to keep. And if your really good rare is not in your opening hand, your hand's going to be, on average, worse, which might mean it's closer to a mulligan.
Right. Especially if you have the lands to cast it, even if the rest of your hand is bad.
Yeah. So I played a game recently where my opponent played a turn 2 Sunset Saboteur on the play and then missed their third land drop, and I won that game, and they asked me, you know, should they have mulliganed, and they almost won that game, though, you know, like just off a turn 2 Sunset Saboteur on the play. I'm like, no, of course not. You know, like if you had hit your third land drop, I would have been completely screwed, you know.
Like, right. Yeah. So cheaper cards. We're in a new era. Cheaper cards are important. Mana efficiency is important. Long-term planning is important. Playing as many spells as you can. Playing more spells than your opponent is often going to win a game. There's a little bit of conflation there with maybe just spending as much mana as your, or more mana than your opponent is actually better because of considerations like mana sinks and more expensive cards, you know, being better than smaller cards. Like maybe if your deck can play 7 drops, you don't quite need to play as many spells as your opponent's deck, but you probably need to still spend about as much mana as they spend.
And then I guess also in the drafting, this is kind of a rule I keep going back to, and I just think it works out. If I'm drafting and I have 2 cards in my hand that I'm kind of deciding between, and it's the last second and I need to pick one, I'm just going to pick the cheaper one. That's the ultimate tiebreaker.
Oh, when you're picking?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
It's just,
that's a pretty good tiebreaker.
Yeah. I think you'll find it just works out better in the long term. I haven't done a lot of serious cube drafting in a while, but I did a year ago, and I used to be in a cube draft server with a lot of the pro players doing drafts for team drafts for 50 tickets and stuff like that. And
sounds fun.
Luis Salvato does a ton of those, and I cube drafted with him in paper, and he gave pretty funny advice where he said, if you don't know what to pick, take the cheapest card in the pack.
Wow, which is full stop, huh?
Yeah, which I think is pretty accurate, especially in cube when the power level is so high.
And the 0 mana cards are the best ones.
Yeah.
But Moxes and Black Lotuses.
Yeah, but even then, I think, you know, the 1 mana interaction thing, I felt like I kind of built up from doing a lot of cube drafts and kind of translated that into Constructed a little bit more too, you know?
Yeah, you know, when I've done these arena cube drafts, it's a lot different than a vintage cube draft because it's just the cards available on Arena, and oftentimes they're trying to fit all the fun 5-mana cards and whatnot in there. I almost never pass Swords to Plowshares, which is on there because it's a special guess. It's like just an absurdly powerful card compared to almost anything else.
It is in Vintage Cube too, as is Dismember, you know, same kind of thing. It's
yeah, so that totally makes sense. Yeah, they're never we're a long ways from them printing a card like Swords to Plowshares again, I think. But
yeah, this is a good one tangent, day, who knows? I keep asking people how good of a 2-mana white removal spell could they make, but it's still like not even seem broken.
Mm-hmm.
And like the line I've been at is like 1 in a white, destroy target creature, its controller gains life equal to its power, is like way better than anything we have in standard, and I also think would just like not make white broken in standard either.
Right. No, it wouldn't. My thought would be like get lost, no maps is too probably too far.
Yeah, being so map maybe, versatile. Yeah.
Yeah. And usually white removal tends to be more versatile, I would say, than like black removal. I think that's kind of like a cool factor of it.
Yeah.
Banishing Light and that sort of thing. Maybe they could print like a 2-mana instant Banishing Light. Might be a little absurd. Maybe with a small drawback to it.
Yeah, I hate the drawbacks.
Just as like a design and gameplay perspective? Yeah. Or
they could probably do what you're... They could probably make like an like CMC 3 or less version of what you're talking about.
Yeah, probably. I think in the new Avatar set, if I'm remembering correctly, there's a 3-mana Flash O-Ring.
Just kind of that makes sense. I think I saw that too. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it might even have some very minor benefit. Very minor, but yeah.
That's the type of card that'll make cancel way better.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. I've been kind of interested. I've been thinking about if I would play a card like that, and I think I might. I think that's close to good. We'll have to try it. Anyways. That ought to do it, huh, for the episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. These fundamental episodes, I think, can be helpful for people. And so if any of our Patreon members, or anyone really, has a topic they'd like to have us cover, please let us know. Or it's a good thing for us when we have some off weeks, like we did this week. So with that, we will see you next time. Okay, so I got a listener question, actually.
Nice.
And they were wondering about the... let me pull it up here. It's the new land in the Spider-Man set. Multiversal Passage. Land. As this land enters, choose a basic land type. Then you may pay 2 life. If you don't, it enters tapped. And the land is the chosen type. So... The question revolves around the fact that when this enters, it'll be the land type, so it'll be an island or a mountain or a swamp. And they were wondering how this interacts with Verges, in Standard specifically, and whether or not, especially decks that don't have a shock land at the moment, whether or not this card would be good in, say, you know, like an Absent deck or something.
Yeah, no, I think I totally... just kind of, I think, missed it when I was looking over for top 10. I probably would have made it. Abzan is kind of weirder, actually. I actually think something like Gruul would probably play this.
Because they have one shock land? Is that the
idea? I guess maybe that's not the right... Like Rakdos. But maybe even Gruul might play some, just, you know, to make their mana a little better. It's a lot like the Pathways... but with this pay 2 life thing tagged on, which I know makes it worse in a 2-color deck, but you might still take it, especially because, the Verge enabling is going to matter too. I guess I'm just thinking about, you know, Gruul, for example, which isn't really a deck anymore. It's all mono reds, but they were playing like 4 Paw Patch Recruits. So like this is a land that still enables a turn 1 Paw Patch Recruit, but still like as long as they already have the green, then they'll just pick red the rest of the game pretty much.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons Starting Town has been a really popular card in Standard, even though it's, you know, probably not as strong as it... I mean, I think it's a good card, but it's seeing it especially a lot of play for the reasons you mentioned. It's kind of funny how we have this odd mana base. I think that's exactly why I didn't put it on my top 10 when I was just reading through. Because in a world where everyone has a shock land, I don't... Like, in a world where Standard has 10 shock lands, you probably don't ever play this card, whereas Starting Town still has some applications.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I was thinking, would you play this in the Cauldron deck instead of Starting Town.
Yeah, you could probably get away with it in that deck. Probably not four, though. But yeah, I guess they're only on two Starting Town. I've kind of been enjoying, I see some of the lists now play Conduit Pylons, which is pretty funny, which is the untapped Surveil lands, but it only makes colorless or filters. But they've kind of decided they can afford to fit in.
That almost makes sense, yeah.
The colorless lands, but have some extra Surveil.
Huh. Talk about a mana efficient, inefficient land.
Yeah.
Pay mana to get mana out of your land.